You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Spin Rate, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Welcome back to Spin Rate. My name is Drew Fairservice. This is the Athletics Toronto Blue Jays podcast. We are excited for a couple of reasons. Number one reason why we're excited, because she's back. It's a Thursday when we're recording this, but Caitlin McGrath, co-host, Blue Jays writer for TheAthletic.com. Caitlin, so glad that you're back.
I'm glad I'm back too. What a day to come back on, coming off a sweep. We have so much to talk about.
It's a very different mood than when we recorded or ordinarily if you listen to this show. And I think that you should. And if you want to, you can subscribe to Spin Rate on anywhere you get your podcasts, on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere that catches your podcast. Go and hit that subscribe button. Give us a like or a rating or a thumbs up, whatever it might be. We appreciate it. And if you want to subscribe to The Athletic, which I really think you should do, you go to theathletic.com/spinrate. Tell them that we sent you. Sign up. Give you a tidy little price. You get all of the great baseball stuff from coast to coast to coast to coast. Everything that Caitlin writes about the Blue Jays, everything that is written about the Raptors, the hockey playoffs are starting at some point in the next 6 or 7 weeks. Look forward to that. They released the NFL schedule, which is like a bigger deal than almost anything that's ever happened in the history of any of the other sports. Go check all the analysis of the NFL schedule. Soccer is coming down to the wire, all the major professional leagues, getting right down to it. Who's going to be into Champions League? Who's going to be West Ham? All of the very important questions are answered on The Athletic, so you want to subscribe. Ordinarily, Caitlin and I do this. We talk about your Toronto Blue Jays on Sundays. This week, we changed it up. Sunday, your friend of mine, Jonah Bierenbaum, joined me, and we had a bummer time destroying poor Nate Pearson and talking about the degree to which the sky was falling upon Blue Jays land. But now, with Caitlin in the mix, we get to have some fun instead and talk about a great series against Atlanta, which comes on the heels of another great series against Atlanta. There's a lot of positives, a lot of fun stuff to talk about. Where else should we start other than, well, what does the Atlanta sweep mean? Well, now we're talking about a team that is 4 games over .500, 20-16. Offense kind of looking the part, starting pitching kind of, you know, after a bit of a rocky start, Russ Stripling look pretty good. This looks like a pretty good baseball team, maybe, Caitlin. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be sort of finding a rhythm here. Earlier this week, ahead of the series, I think like Monday, I was looking back at just like the sort of rhythms of the season, like the win-loss record and how their season had gone. And if you kind of look back, they really didn't have a lot of momentum. Like their longest winning streak, I think, was 3 games before this. Also, when they swept Atlanta the previous time, I think at one point they had a 4-game losing streak, but it was very much just like win, 2 losses, 2 wins, a loss. Like it was just like kind of choppy, I guess. And that's not entirely abnormal for a start of the season. It's April. They were just kind of hovering around .500, I guess is the point. Like they weren't going on a run, but they weren't, you know, losing a ton. They were just like hovering around that point, playing fine. And now 4 games up of the .500 mark, like you said, it's starting to feel like the Blue Jays are gelling. The lineup is obviously gelling a little bit, not everybody in the lineup. And I'm sure we'll get into some of the guys that are still having some slow starts there, but the top of the lineup for sure is really coming together. The team is like finding their identity. Like I feel like they're sort of getting back to that little bit like offensively dangerous, kind of scrappy, don't quit team. We've seen them. What was there, two comeback wins in this Atlanta series? Right. So like a couple of that, they've done that quite a few times this season. Also defensively, quietly under the radar, they've been much better defensively, which is funny because it's like the first 2 weeks of the season, the major storyline is like, well, oh my gosh, the defense hasn't improved. What are you going to do with that infield? And not to say that, like, you know, those problems could pop up again throughout the season, but it is funny that now no one's really talking about the defense. So actually, like, everything is kind of coming together. I wouldn't say like necessarily anything is shocking me. I think like the offense is performing how I pretty much thought they would. The pitching has been pretty surprising, but it's been surprising since the start of the year, so it's not surprising anymore. And like I said, the defense is kind of coming along. So yeah, it's kind of getting into a groove here. I feel like me covering the team playing, it's kind of settling in nicely.
You're hitting your stride. The sun is out. Yeah. Sun's out a little bit later. You're hitting your stride. I get that. I feel like for the first month of the season, the Blue Jays looked like a kind of a mediocre 500 team, which I don't think is an unrealistic way to examine them, especially when if you take how they were playing, kind of extrapolate it forward, be like, okay, maybe this will come up, this will come down. You know, they're not underperforming to be at or around 500, a game below, a game above, sort of back and forth. You know, there were extenuating circumstances when you look at why they were performing at that level. Oh, okay, well, the offense, what they were, you know, obviously Vladimir Guerrero Jr. got off to an amazing start, but some of the other, there were more players really, truly, and awfully underperforming than there were performing at or above their expectation. Where one of the things that has kind of pushed them along a little bit of late as they've started to creep a little bit higher and higher above that 500 mark and start to look a little bit more like themselves in the process is that while you, as you mentioned, there are still a few players who might be struggling in the lineup, but there's what, like one or two, maybe like black holes, what we would say, like just guys who are not really able to contribute really anything at this point. But some of the other players, Kevin Biggio has pushed his season numbers up to just a shade under league average now. You know, over the last week or so in particular, he's been really good. They keep walking him and he's also started to really, you know, look and have the opportunity to do some damage. Did some really good base running as well. I think the defense is an important thing, which is to say that it's kind of a symptom of defense as a whole, which is to say that defensive chances aren't distributed equally, right? Every third baseman doesn't get the same a set number of challenging third plays to make at third base. But also, when the offense is in a better position, those errors and misplays and plays not made don't loom as large, you know, because they still do make them. They still had those plays not made. And there was a couple examples, I think it was in the first game against Atlanta where a potential double play, but the relay throw that came into second kind of pulled Marcus Simeon to the wrong side of the bag. So they got the lead out. So again, those are like also, you know, I think they're orders of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like magnitude, orders of magnitude, where a play not made, but you still get the lead runner is different than, you know, a ball that goes through the legs or a ball that's thrown into left field, whatever it might be. So I think, you know, as Bo Bichette started to swing a much better bat, Teoscar Hernandez has been great since he came back from COVID. They look, to your point, a lot more like themselves while still getting quality performances out of the bullpen. And I think a somewhat surprising kind of every trip through the rotation feels like a little bit of a pleasant surprise in that, you know, Robbie Ray hasn't forgot how to throw strikes and Ross Stripling can start out a little wacky. And then the next thing you know, he's racking up the strikeouts. It's you could do worse if you're the Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah, I think I would agree with what you all said there. And I'm sorry, I was like looking at my phone because I pulled up the standings and I don't know if is it safe to look at the standings yet? I know we haven't even got through 2 months, so it's probably still too early to even look at the standings or pay attention to it. But I just actually wanted to see like where the Blue Jays are doing, like keeping pace. Cause I know the Yankees have kind of turned it around. They're not the worst team in the league anymore. Or whatever it was, worst team in the division. But yeah, no, the Blue Jays are like 20-16, which is exactly what the Yankees are, but I think they're playing right now. Maybe. Mm-hmm. And the Boston has lost three in a row. And so they're at 22 wins. So the it's kind of normalizing. I'm just like looking at the whole standings, and not that we need to get into this, but like there's only a few things in the standings that are like kind of surprising right now. I think like the most surprising thing is the Twins being weirdly bad, but maybe that's not that surprising. I mean,
they're calling for Rocco's head. They're calling for his job. There was somebody sitting in the front row at Target Field with a Fire Rocco sign, which to me personally offensive. How dare you? Honestly, Rocco Baldelli, the king, manager of the Twins. If the Twins don't want him, I'm sure that Toronto would be a nice soft landing spot.
Blue Jays could slide him into one of those, like, what are those, like, sort of, like, random coaching jobs? Oh, like, quality control?
No, the one, I was thinking of is manager of the team. That would be a good job for Rocco Baldelli. But you're right. And we're still in very much in the terms of signal versus noise. We're still in the noise part of the season. You know, there's the old baseball adage that I say probably every episode, which is that don't believe anything you see in April and September. So there's a lot of truth to that in a lot of the teams in the American League East. You probably would be foolish to believe too much of what you saw from Baltimore and in the early parts of April and the Red Sox. Not to say the Red Sox are bad, but I don't think that they're the first place good. Same with the Yankees. That's not who they are. So as the amount of quality information starts to roll in, we can start to get a better sense of where these teams stack up, what teams are in need of what upgrades, what teams are maybe just, maybe it's just not their year. Who's can't overcome their injuries. Who's getting, you know, this kind of surprise performances, you know, career years out of somebody. The biggest challenge, I think right now, especially to do what you do, which is why I think it's probably okay I looked at it too, but like we'll put the standings aside because the schedule is so unbalanced so far. The Blue Jays still won't play Baltimore for another, I think, 3 weeks. They won't play them until the middle of June, and then they'll play the Baltimore Orioles 19 times between June and the end of the season. So the Red Sox have had their shot at the Orioles. The Yankees have had their shot at the Orioles. They've both kind of gotten fat off of playing the Trash Birds. I think both the Red Sox and the Yankees have already played the Tigers, which the Blue Jays have not had the pleasure of welcoming the old English D to town or to Tampa, because that's good eating. That Tigers team is a debacle, unfortunately. You gotta love the, you know, there's so much about the Tigers that's so easy to love, but they're not in a good place. So I think the most important thing is rather than grading them against each other, but just take a look at what you're seeing in the field. What's real? What's fiction? Like, so if you see what Kevin Biggio is doing right now, he's not a 950 OPS guy, but his season numbers are starting to look more like what we expect from Kevin Biggio in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, no, I think I was looking it up today, the last seven games or something, like his on-base percentage is like 500, which obviously he's not going to do that all season. But overall, you see like his season on-base is now up to like, I don't know what it is, like 330 or something. And that's above career, above average. So yeah, you're seeing kind of things normalize a little bit. And I don't think Teoscar Hernandez is going to hit like 400 for the rest of the season. As we saw Vladdy, he's not hitting 400 anymore. It was a great first month for him hovering around that mark, but he's kind of come down to earth and that's also still hitting 300, which is still pretty good. I think he's capable of actually being a 300 hitter. Maybe not quite 300 this year, but I don't know. He could do it. I wouldn't be shocked. We've talked about this before.
If ever there was anyone who was going to be a 300 hitter, it's somebody who A, hits the ball as hard as Vlad does, but B, someone who also puts the ball in play as often as he does. So the one thing I'm keen to look at when I was looking at Vlad's numbers, and I've written about this a little bit, is that he's not been as strong in May, and he had a great game, I guess Tuesday night against Atlanta, where he hit that opposite field home run, and then he had another laser single that he pulled through the infield, and then he had an infield hit. But even though his production wasn't what it was, his walk rate, almost identical to April, like, which is 15, 16, 17% of his plate appearances end in walks. Again, it's early in the season, so some of that stuff gets skewed. The last time the Blue Jays played Atlanta, they wanted nothing to do with him. They walked him like five times in three games. his strikeout rate is still low, and is of course his exit velocity is still high. He had a bit of a bad habit of kind of doing pulling the ball a lot, and then again we saw him in that game where he hit that opposite field. Excuse me, he hit that opposite field home run. Continued to hit the ball hard. He was 1 for 5, I think, here on Thursday, but still hitting the ball hard, still doing Vlad stuff. There's no reason to believe that what he's doing is a mirage, but we've also seen kind of Randall Grichuk kind of come back down to earth a little bit. But then you see Danny Jansen isn't worse than a pitcher, right? Danny Jansen's not worse than a pitcher. Marcus Semien is continuing to play really well. And then, like you said, Teoscar Hernandez is of course doing a lot of the heavy lifting. I got maybe one question, one point of contention. I think you were kind of alluding to this earlier, is the play of Lourdes Gurriel Jr. He seems to be the kind of not odd man out, but he's almost like first overboard when there's a sign of maybe either some water coming on or there's a need to batten down the hatches a little bit. We're going all in on naval analogies here, but he's been struggling. You know, I guess I'm trying to say, what do you think of what you've seen from Lourdes Gurriel so far? A player who is known to be streaky, guy doesn't take a lot of walks, really good at putting the bat on the ball, but here we are into May, and he's still not kind of caught fire like maybe we would have expected him to at some point or another.
Yeah, and there was a couple signs like a week or so ago, or I don't know, it was a few games ago, where he was starting to hit a little bit. Like, I think he had a couple hits, maybe he had a home run. Like, there was a few games there where he had like a home run and a few long hits, and it kind of felt like, oh, okay, here's Lourdes coming around. Like, this is when the streak's going to start. He's going to figure it out. Because that's kind of like what his MO has been over his career, is that he goes on these like tears. I remember I think it was my first season covering the team. So it was like 2018. It was when he was a rookie. And he went on that crazy streak, and it was like an MLB record streak of games for a rookie. And I remember he like, it was like in Chicago where he had like broken the record or tied the record. And then in that same game, he ended up getting hurt. And then I think he missed a bunch of time, and then he came back, and like the record was like still, because he hadn't played, it like still stood, but then like he ended up not getting a hit or something. It was like over, even though it was kind of anticlimactic by that point. But anyway, so needless to say, I've seen him go on these streaks. That was a tangent, but
and which in no way paralleled the story that you were telling.
What? Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that, like,
I know, you know what I mean.
I've followed Lourdes's career since he came up in 2018, and I've seen him from the very beginning go on these tears. And they happen, and then they stop, and then he gets injured, and then he can't hit because he's out of a rhythm, and then he comes back, and then he hits, and then like he's just like a choppy guy. Like, I don't know, that's how he's played.
Are you talking about Lourdes Gurriel Jr. or Bo Bichette? Because I think that there are similarities between those two players in the way that their approaches, and there maybe are some worrisome signs about that approach. They're both guys that don't draw a lot of walks. They have great hand-eye coordination. They're really good at putting the bat on the ball. And as you know, as we're seeing right now with Bo Bichette, he's off to a good start. I was looking at his most recent updated numbers after he got two big hits today. He's at like a 126 weighted runs created plus, so he's 26% better than league average. And that's more than fine. That's very good for a shortstop. But it's all powered by his ability to put the bat on the ball and drive and pick up hits. Because when you put a lot of pressure on yourself, when you are swinging at bat balls and trying to turn balls into hits instead of waiting to do damage on pitches in the strike zone. And, you know, when we had Eno Saris on the show a few weeks ago, and he talked about that's not a skill that ages well, typically. The ability to expand the zone and go out and hit stuff that's, you know, unless you're Vladimir Guerrero Sr., which everyone loves to remember and points to, but that's what made him such a freak. And that's why everybody knows that about him, because to hit it off the damn bounce or put it off your shoe tops or at your eyes is hard. It's hard to do, and it's hard to do it for a long time. So maybe there are some worrisome signs about Lourdes Gurriel's approach. Not to say that he's some kind of old man who's lost, you know, lost a tick of bat speed or a little bit of hand-eye coordination, but it is something to be wary of. That said, that ability to kind of get locked in and you know, there's a maybe like a something of like a Bronze Age baseball stat sort of, there was a whole thing about there's no such thing as hot streaks, right? Because you just got to, it's all about arbitrary endpoints. So sure, if you zoom in, you can say that this streak was hot, this streak was cold. But when you zoom out enough, a player is who a player is, which I would agree to an extent, except that there are so many things going on in not only a baseball swing, but a baseball at bat, but a baseball, about a batter's mentality, a batter's vision, a batter's physical comfort. Like, it's just not so simple to say, this is who he is. Lourdes Gurriel is an ex true talent player, and he's always going to hit like that in the long run. A player with a long swing, a player with so much that puts so much pressure on his ability to put the bat on the ball. It's a, you know, we're talking about fractions of centimeters in terms of what something that might be barreled, something that might be off the end, something that might be topped, something that they might get under. So I very much believe that players can get locked in. I'm the hot hand theory, however you want to look at it. I'm maybe speaking, you know, ignorantly or outside of the realms of mathematics and what statistics have shown. But guys can get hot and guys can get cold. Guys' swing can get long. They can get wacky. They can be hurt, whatever it might be. So I don't doubt that there's another hot streak in Lourdes Gurriel, but maybe, just maybe, something to be wary of. And they obviously don't think he's a very good defender as well. Full stop.
I haven't really been, I mean, obviously his routes are a bit wacky in left fields. I think he often can make up for some of that with his arm. I don't know, mm-hmm. like you kind of give and take a little bit with Lourdes Gurriel Jr. I do mm-hmm. remember though, like, yeah, his, like, if you looked at it coming into this season, the sample of games that he had was probably like a season's worth between three seasons. And his numbers were like quite a bit above average, and it's still not like a huge sample. So I think, like, yeah, the jury's still out with Lourdes Gurriel Jr. But at the same time, like, if you looked at the big picture, he had been a very solid, above average offensive performer for the Blue Jays over his first three seasons. It just, like, the sample and whatnot was a little bit disjointed because he did miss a lot of time with injuries, and you did see him kind of struggle and go up and down a little bit early on. I mean, he's still, it's one thing, like, we talk a lot about the young players like Vlad being 22 and Bo being 23, and Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is a little bit older than them in terms of age, but he's really not much older than them in terms of like playing experience. He was mm-hmm. in their class when it comes to like when they were coming at the minor leagues. Like, they were together in New Hampshire a few years ago. He accelerated a little bit more, just I think because of his age, and the Blue Jays were more comfortable kind of rushing him up the system as opposed to somebody else younger, like a Bo, who they wanted to have him progress at every minor league level. But I do think that, you know, like, let's look at someone like Teoscar Hernandez, who 2 years ago we're talking about Teoscar Hernandez maybe not even being able to be a major league hitter, right? Like, he was so bad in 2019 that he got sent down to the minors, which was a huge wake-up call for him. That also happened to Lourdes Gurriel Jr. in 2019 as well. But yeah, just like Teoscar Hernandez is an example of somebody who did, I don't want to say peaking too late, because I mean, he's 28 now, and last year was really his breakout season, and it kind of actually started in the later half of 2019. He really started coming around. So, but it did take him a few years to kind of figure it out. He obviously had some troubling signs, like Lourdes Gurriel Jr., like the strikeout numbers were very high. Probably has more power, does have the more raw power than mm-hmm. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. But there are some similarities. And so not to say that, like, look, Lourdes could not work out. He could be a bust, or he mm-hmm. could just kind of be starting slowly this year, he could be another sort of like example of a Teoscar that does go through these ups and downs, streaky player for his first few years. And then maybe, and I mean, Teoscar, he still has to consistently do it this year too. So let's not, like, the book isn't sort of written on him fully yet, but we have seen a turnaround could happen for Lourdes too.
I would say this. I don't disagree. Well, I do disagree, maybe isn't the right word. I would say that A, Lourdes Gurriel is 27, so he is not exactly a young guy. I wouldn't consider him a bust because he's already got, he's going to pass 1,000 career plate appearances, you know, this month, which is the number of people who have would have attempted or embarked upon a career or a life in professional baseball to reach that kind of a threshold is really, really minimal. So I would never want to go ahead and say that Lourdes Gurriel is a bust. But in your example, the difference between Teoscar Hernandez and Lourdes Gurriel is a difference of approach, where even at Teoscar's career worst walk rate, which is what he's putting up right now in 2021 in a very short season in which he missed time, is still better than Lourdes Gurriel's best career walk rate. The challenge, and what I've said was the point I was trying to make before, is that Lourdes Gurriel's profile puts a ton of pressure on him to be a very, very good bat-to-ball hitter. And you've seen it in his old numbers. He has power. He's got quite a bit of power, a different kind of power than I think than Teoscar Hernandez. But if you look at, say, you know, again, talk about Bronze Age stats, like his batting average on balls in play has always been quite high. Again, this is a guy who puts the ball in play a lot, uses the whole field, has shown an ability to go to right field, as well as, you know, home run power to left. But without the patience, and when he's swinging at pitches that aren't strikes, putting all that pressure on his ability to, like, put that ball in play and do so with power and do so in a way that is going to have those balls land in as hits, is different than Teoscar Hernandez sort of kind of high walk rate, struck out a lot, but obviously like plus power that as soon as he starts to cut his strikeout rate, he's immediately a better player. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is not a player who's really ever struck out that much. He strikes out at about a league average rate. So again, he puts extra pressure on himself by putting the ball in play all the time, never walking. There's only kind of one way out of that, right? And that's just through getting tons of hits. And even, you know, a guy like Jose Altuve kind of changed that profile by magic, where he was a guy that didn't walk but was like a great hitter, great singles hitter. You know, everyone loves, oh, he's a professional hitter. Look at that bat speed. Look at him. He's in the whole field. But it's hard. It's hard to make a living like that, especially as you start to get a little bit older. So experience or otherwise, Lourdes Gurriel is 27. He'll be 28 this year. It's a dangerous game to play. The I'm a all contact all the time, never walk guy. I mean, even his brother, right? Look at Yuli is having one of the best seasons, his off to a great start because he's walking a ton and because he's hitting the ball hard and he's not striking out at all. So it's interesting to it's all about adjustments, I think, right? Guys are going to be who they are. And I don't think anyone's going to ever expect Lourdes Gurriel to walk as much as, you know, Vlad or Joey Votto or anybody like that. He's going to be who he is. But again, that pressure, the pressure on that profile might get a little dicey at times. We'll be right back with more Spin Rate, but first, check this out.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
I want to know, because so again, when we last recorded, Jonah and I had a lot to say about Nate Pearson, and I want to know what you think about Nate Pearson, who of course was sent down this week, sent back to Buffalo to continue to work, to maybe continue to grow comfortable in his new mechanics. I'd love to know, Caitlin, what you think about this Nate Pearson saga here over the last 6 or 7 days.
Well, I'm glad you asked, because I did listen to you guys last.
Oh, that was nice of you. Thank you.
Yeah, I listened to the podcast, and there was a point where you guys were talking about Nate Pearson, and I was like, I want to make this point. Like, I was like screaming into like, you know, the void of like wanting to make this point about Nate Pearson. It's not even really a point. It's just something that I don't think you guys brought up. And I think it just like adds to like the mystery or the intrigue as to like what is happening with Nate Pearson, is that if you guys recall, when he came back at the end of last season and he was coming out of the bullpen, it was like he only threw strikes. Like, he was really effective, and he was throwing really hard. Obviously, he was coming out of the bullpen. And so I just think that it's a very strange thing that has happened when he has sort of lost the strike zone as a starter. We've really seen him wobble, but at the same time, I don't know that it's a major league thing, because when he came into those relief appearances, yeah, it was a tiny sample. It was really only like one or two appearances in the season, and I think one appearance in the playoffs. But he looked like a guy who was able to throw a lot of strikes. And so it's not quite as simple as like, well, maybe it's the pressure of the major leagues, because we've seen him do it in the major leagues, just in a different role and a different circumstance and a little bit less pressure. I mean, of course it was less pressure, because at that point, I think the Blue Jays were, they had sewn up a playoff spot, right? It was like right at the end of the season. So there's absolutely
against
no
Baltimore
pressure.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was like low pressure, low stakes, but just to add to this sort of like, as I say, the intrigue of what is happening with Nate Pearson, that element of, yeah, he was super effective in that brief time as a reliever last year, which I sort of, I don't know that you guys came to any sort of conclusion. I think that you guys were sort of just talking your way through it. And I sort of have done the
entertainingly,
same.
Entertainingly.
Yeah, no, yeah, I was entertained.
Edutainment, as we talked about Nate Pearson.
Yeah, but like, I am sort of similar to you in that I don't really know what's happening. I certainly, you can say it's a mental thing. Obviously, pitching can be really stressful. It can be it can be as mental as it is physical. And it's difficult to figure out what's happening with Pearson, because I don't know him well, but I've been in scenarios where he's talking to the press and he's not necessarily a guy that is short on confidence. So he's very confident in himself. He's a smart guy. He's very attuned to analytics, to his body, to what works, to what doesn't. He studies the numbers. You know, you could get to a point where maybe you ask, is he studying the numbers too much, or is he finicking with his mechanics? But I think the mechanical adjustment that he made that you guys touched on, that, yeah, that's a challenge. But I think it was something that he sort of had to do, or felt like he had to do, because of the stress that he was putting on his body, which kind of led to that groin strain, and the re-aggravation of the groin strain was because of the mechanics that he had. So it was kind of necessary for him, I think, to make that adjustment. He felt like the adjustment was actually going to lead to more control, more command. Didn't see that. To be honest with the audience, I didn't watch the start. I didn't go back. I was not able to watch that start. So I think I listened to some of it on the radio or something, or maybe just kind of hearing the commentary of it. But you guys kind of painted the picture of that he wasn't even really close to the zone.
Oh no, he was not close. it was real bad. And that was the point that Jonah and I made at that time, which was the difference between, again, the point that was sort of made by some, and actually Stoughton in his Batflip newsletter kind of broke it down, and he showed pitch maps for each of the games in a way, which was, again, the misses in the game against Houston were just so bad and like all over the map. But also Stoughton made a good point, which is that he wasn't really supposed to be up, and it's not unfair to say that Nate Pearson could have been very much fighting his mechanics the whole way through, because these are brand new. This is a whole new thing. So he's fighting through them. And while I, when we previously we previously recorded advocated letting him stay up and even kind of getting his brains beat in and just sort of making that mental adjustment, working closely with Matt Bushman and Pete Walker, who are as good as it gets. Matt Bushman, though, what a stud. Whenever they show him in the dugout, in the bullpen, like on the bullpen cams, I'm like, who's that? Well, that guy is too young and too good looking to be a bullpen coach. That shouldn't be allowed. He looks like he's just going to run out onto the field himself and play. He's too young, too good. I don't like it. I need, bring me like an old man who's like kind of slowly decaying out in the bullpen. He's like part sunflower seed, part tin of chew, and just like his only job is to answer the phone. I don't know, all those newfangled muscle guys out there, like guys who can squat a small school bus. Get out of here, Matt Bushman. But anyway, that was what I suggested, and Stoughton made a point in his newsletter that was like, he needs to go down and pitch and to be in a situation where those mechanics can be the focus. Maybe I'm paraphrasing a bit here. I don't want to put too many words into Stone's mouth. But like, he needs to go down and like, just if he can focus on the mechanics, worry only about that, pitch in a place where the results are as close to meaningless as possible, because it's AAA, and as baseball has shown, and as actually Craig Goldstein and I talked about on an episode a couple weeks ago, they've basically stripped all meaning from the average minor league game to the worse, not the better. But in Nate Pearson's case, if it lets him go down there and just really work through it, really kind of understand what it means to when he's fighting those mechanics, to become even more comfortable with it. Because the fact that he blew away whoever they were facing, if they were Rochester, God only knows who he faced in his start. I can't remember. They changed everything in the minor leagues. I don't know anything anymore. I never really did. But so let him focus on that. And I would say this, Stoughton made a compelling case. I don't think that I didn't necessarily change my mind, but it's just good to take in all that information and think that whether or not, if it's in his head because he's worried about his mechanics or he's worried about trying to be the best, because that was the thing. And I don't know, you know, you've been around him and saw him maybe last spring in particular, where there was so much hope and it was like, oh, his mentality, he's like Halliday and he's this and that. Maybe that could work against him, and especially when he's fighting his mechanics and not sure of what he's about to do or where the next pitch he's going to throw is going to end up.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to pretend that I know Nate Pearson very well, but I'll go back to
personal friend Caitlin McGrath here with a take.
I did meet his parents. I did talk to his parents last spring.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. They were at his first start in Dunedin because they live close by, obviously. I think I'd go back to the point, though, is just like, I feel like he is really confident in himself, and he doesn't, I guess sometimes he does seem like so confident in himself, but also sometimes those types of people can be very hard on themselves. And I think we've seen him on the mound doing that self-talk, and sometimes it does look like he's frustrated, right? And I think that was something that happened a little bit last year, where you thought, well, maybe Nate Pearson is going to have to work a little bit on emotions on the mound. And he's a young starter. He's still kind of learning the league, but it did look at sometimes that he was frustrated with himself. Understandably, if you're not pitching the way you want to be, obviously you're going to be frustrated with yourself. No one blames him for that. But I do think that a guy as competitive and as driven as him, he wants to be the best pitcher that he can possibly be. He wants to be a starter. He wants to throw hard. He has all these goals. If you're not achieving them, and you don't feel like you're on the path to achieving them, you feel like you're frustrated with injuries and all that kind of stuff, you can be really hard on yourself. And I think a high pressure person, we've seen examples in your life of those types of people that are perfectionist type people, and they are so, you know, they could beat themselves up and they're hard on people. So I do think there's maybe there could be some element of that with Nate Pearson, where, like I said, the competitive drive is one thing and it's really admirable, but there's a fine line too there, where you want to make sure that he's still sort of being nice to himself, understanding that pitching is difficult to do. A young pitcher is going to take time. I'm sure he's aware of it. I'm sure people have told him these things. And you know, to back to your point though, what you were saying before, and I'll just add that I was surprised. Well, how should I say this? I was surprised that they called him up, in the sense that I heard him say I want to say it was before his first start in the minors, that he was kind of under the impression, or he said the team's message to him was that he needs to go out, he needs to throw 6-7 solid innings, and then that's what the team wants to see from him to get called up.
Wow.
His first start was solid, but it was like, what, not even 4 innings? It was like,
no.
Yeah,
three, so two-thirds, yeah.
He struck out a lot of guys. The pitch count was kind of high. He was still kind of building himself back from injury. And so I say I'm surprised because I kind of thought they would give him more runway in the minors, mm-hmm. get him to that 6-7 inning point, and then call him up when he's in a groove. I'm not surprised because I've covered the Blue Jays long enough to never be surprised by anything they do. I'm always on my toes. There's always, they always do something that I'm not expecting. Like last year when I was like, there's no way they're going to call up Alejandro Kirk. That's not going to happen. Oh, he's on the taxi. He's on the taxi squad. No, he's just here to learn about the major leagues. It's like a little field trip up to the majors. And then like 2 days later, they're like, by the way, Alejandro Kirk is on the roster now. He's debuting tonight. So
Alejandro Kirk no longer on the roster. He's on the 60-day injured list.
Yes, he is. But this, to my point, is that I learned my lesson then, and I continue to learn it now, is that I can sort of be surprised when they make a decision, but I remain ready for any decision they make. And that's why I am fully on guard for an Alec Manoa call up, because
you're doing my job for me here. We're ready to talk about Alec Manoa. Go ahead, finish your point. I'm cutting you off.
I was just gonna sum that up, is like, do I think it will happen soon? Not necessarily. Do I think that he probably conventional wisdom would say that he needs more time in the minor leagues, and we've seen examples of guys coming up, aka Nate Pearson, and not going so smoothly. Yes, I have all that. I'm aware of all that, but as I say, I expect the unexpected with the Blue Jays. So if you told me tomorrow Alec Manoa is coming up and he's going to start on the weekend, although I don't know that that doesn't time out with his schedule, but whatever his next start day is supposed to be, if he is starting with the Blue Jays, I'd be like, oh, all right, Alec Manoa is starting for the Blue Jays.
So two things. Number one, a 6-7 inning Nate Pearson start is going to be like 200 pitches. So there's no way they're going to let him do that. They'd be sent to prison. And the other thing is, I've heard, Pat Tabler is very much, I will say this about Pat Tabler. I've kind of graduated beyond the criticize or have very loud outward public opinions about the broadcast. Pat Tabler is very good hearted in the broadcast booth. A lot of guys, especially Pat Tabler is an older man, they complain about the state of the game. And I would not ever say that Pat Tabler is the kind of guy who complains about the way that the game is. He accepts it from my personal observations. Pat Tabler accepts that the game is different. He leans on his own lived experience or his own experience in the game, which is not necessarily aligned with where the game is. But I don't hear him complain, which to his credit, because there's nothing worse than that. There's nothing worse than a broadcaster who's sitting up there in the press box griping about the game that they're being paid to cover and watch. So credit to Pat Tabler. But one of his kind of old saws is about, getting experience, and Alec Manoa's got to get experience. And I don't care about experience personally. Again, the experience is the grind experience, I think, is really important. And I feel like we've talked about this a few different times recently, which is that that to me is the experience of being a professional. And it's true of baseball pitchers. It's true of everyone that, I thought a lot about it. And I think it was actually when Craig Goldstein was on a few weeks ago, we talked about the value of the minor leagues for that. And it's the ability to learn how to grind, where when Alec Manoa comes out and it's his first start and he's all geared up and he feels like $1 million and he hasn't pitched 115 innings that season and he's not been on a bus ride all night long, and he can come out and he can blow people away. He can locate all of his pitches. He can get ahead and then he can just do whatever he wants. The true mark of, I think, a professional in a lot of ways is what happens when one of those things isn't working. What happens when he's in the bullpen and he's like, my curveball, I can't find it today. That changeup, I just can't find the zone with it. I'm not able to get to that outside corner against lefties with my change. What are we going to do? That to me is a huge mark of a professional. And that is what it means in a lot of ways to gain experience for me. That said, if you are the Blue Jays and you send Alec Manoah out there with specific instructions, like, Alec, we want to see you throw your fastball inside to lefties consistently, because you're going to need to be able to do that. We would need to see you spot this curveball in that spot. When he can move, if he can do those things, if there's a checklist of, like, you're not going to be able to pitch in the big leagues if you can't, you know, there's talk about Tyler Chatwood, how he moved to the other side of the mound this week so he can better locate his fastball inside the lefties. That sort of thing. If they can ask Alec Manoah to, like, do a list of whatever it is based on what they know about him and his repertoire and how he's going to need to get big leaguers out, then let him go. Let him pitch in the big leagues. And again, this is based on nothing. This is based on less than nothing. It's based off one quote and I'm not sure what page of Baseball Savant you'd find it, but Alec Manoah's vibe is off the charts. I believe you would call, it's a bit of an indelicate term. He's got a lot of, like, just like big dick donkey energy. Like, he's big and he's got tattoos and he's kind of grimy and he just gets up there and he's like, I'm big as fuck. What are you going to do? Sign me up. I love it. Nate Pearson, clean cut. Maybe a little wound a little tight right now. Alec Manoah out there, free and easy. Big man loving life. And the whole, his quote about the stuff plays, man. Every time I see him, it's all I can think. I'm like, because it does. The stuff plays. He knows it. And everybody in the other dugout knows it too. Bring him up. All I want to see is Alec Manoah. Sign me up for all the big dick donkeys you can find and want. Send him out to the mound. Just huck BBs all day long. I'm all the way in.
I mean, I think you're going to get it this year. I do think it's going to happen.
I'm going to get the big dick donkeys. Yeah.
I don't know when. My bet would be, knowing I'm usually wrong about this stuff, my bet would be sooner than later, because my normal suspicion would be later in the season, second half of the season. But again, I'm sort of leaning into the fact that I'm always wrong about this stuff. I need to forget what I think is going to happen or what conventional wisdom says, because I've seen the Blue Jays kind of pivot on that the last couple seasons, and they've been more aggressive. I think pitching is one thing where they tend to be more traditional and more patient. Although, again, with the Nate Pearson thing, not to continue to go back to that, but they did surprise me a little bit with calling him up. Maybe that was just to, like, give him the chance to take it and run with it, sort of hope that he did. He obviously didn't. And now they sort of reassess, okay, like, let's keep him down in the minors for a little bit. But yeah, Alec Manoah is, like you said, very confident. A different kind of confidence, though. Like, you know, him and Nate Pearson are quite different. I'm at the point where I would like to see it. He's really entertaining. He's a really, like, fun guy to talk to. Like you said, that quote, there was another part of that quote that was really great. I know, like, the stuff plays was, like, sort of the soundbite of that.
Because it's so good. I love it.
It was like, yeah, it was a really excellent quote. So from, as the journalist and the writer in me, bring them up so I can get some of those quotes into my stories. Think of those headlines. Think of those quote pulls that we could get from Alec Manoah. He story writes itself practically. So, I don't know. I don't know when it's going to happen. I think it's safe to say it's probably going to happen at some point this year. Like I said,
I guess the question is, and maybe that's part of the Blue Jays philosophy, and it's why wait. Again, if I think that with all of the talent evaluators that they have and all of the kind of metrics that they're able to derive, if there are key performance indicators that suggest he is ready to go, then have it, like, let him go. You're getting past, or if you're not already, you're past whatever service time barriers you need to overcome. You know, whether those things mean anything next year and into the future, who knows? But if you're a talent evaluator in the Blue Jays system and you can say he's embarrassing minor leaguers because they can't touch his fastball no matter what, so everything else is just gravy, as opposed to this is stuff that will get big league hitters out. And if they can make that call and be like, oh yeah, no, it doesn't matter. There's nobody who he's going to face in AAA that can get close. And he's not afraid to fill the strike zone, and he looks like $1 million, and he seems like a really chill bro, pull it up. More Spin Rate coming up right after these words from our sponsors. Let's talk about doing the splits, Caitlin. You wrote a very entertaining story that did very, I think it did pretty well. It seemed like you did pop, a little pop on that story. You had to mute that thread.
I didn't mute that thread. I don't mute the threads that are giving me all this praise.
There keep you go. Coming. The true writer, true writer tudes are coming out here. So Caitlin, for the folks who haven't yet read it, and if they haven't, I assume it's because they don't subscribe to The Athletic, which they should do by going to theathletic.com/spinrate and signing the hell up. Who did you talk to about doing the splits and why? Why the splits?
Well, I think from the start of the season, I think one of the most surprising parts of Vlad's game has been the sort of improved flexibility that he's been flashing at first base. And I think I want to say it was very early in the season he did the first splits. I don't know if it was the first game, but it was like, I think it was the first series at least he did the splits. And he's done them throughout the season. You know, some were deeper splits than others, but he's definitely flashing that flexibility. And so I guess the inspiration for the story was just, I want to write about him doing the splits because, and this was kind of proven, the thesis or the sort of the reason for doing the story, which I say is proven based on the reaction, because it's been pretty good, is that people love the splits. Like people love watching people do the splits. People love apparently reading about the splits. People love talking about the splits. Like it is just something that, and this is sort of one of the points that's made in the story, is that it's something that is both relatable in the sense that maybe we've all tried it as a young child or whatever, but it's also completely unrelatable because most people can't do it. So it's like one of these things where we're all kind of amazed by it. I think you're especially amazed by someone like Vlad Guerrero Jr. being able to do it because
he's a big boy. He's a big man.
And we haven't seen him do it before. And so kind of part of the story was that the splits and him being able to do the splits kind of totally is a kind of a symbol of the physical transformation that he has gone through. And really like, it's an extreme example of it, but I think the fact that he has shown this kind of strength and mobility and flexibility at first base just kind of totally encapsulates how much he's transformed from where he was last year or even 2 years ago, like how much of a player he's changed. It's smirking a lot. Do you want
to? So there's two things. The story's great. You talk to a lot of really interesting people. Jamie McLennan, is that Noodles? Is that his name? Noodles?
Yeah. So the people I talked to were Kyle Schufelt, who is a three-time Canadian Olympic gymnast who won a gold medal for floor routine in 2004. And he's also like a CBC commentator for gymnastics. So, and I talked to a yoga instructor, practitioner. She was also someone that I just found. And she also grew up participating in gymnastics. Mm-hmm. I talked to, as you say, Jamie McLennan, Noodles. And I talked to Heather Ogden, who is a principal dancer for the National Ballet of Canada. And I will say that one of the sort of inspirations for the story is I've seen this done a few times with baseball reporters turning to ballet dancers and asking them about certain plays. I remember a few years ago, like Brandon Kennedy for the Toronto Star, he's not a sports reporter anymore, but he did a story about Troy Tulowitzki and how graceful he was at shortstop. And he compared it to a ballet dancer. And there was a story a couple years ago in the Boston Globe where they took a catch that Andrew Benintendi made because it was very graceful and it looked exactly like sort of a ballet jump. And so they called someone up from, I think, like the Boston Ballet, and they talked about sort of the similarities between what he did in the field and what you typically see on a stage. So I sort of just wanted to take that format to look at the splits, ask people who know a lot about the splits, who's done many splits in their lives, who know a lot about what the move takes and how challenging it is, and ask them to look at what Vlad was doing, give me their sort of take on what Vlad is able to do, but also just give me an idea of how difficult it is to do and what it actually means to see him do that.
So two things. Shout out to Brandon Kennedy. He's a really good dude and a really good reporter who's done a lot of great stuff since he left the Blue Jays beat. If you don't follow Brandon on Twitter, who writes, of course, for the Toronto Star, I recommend that. The reason I keep smirking is because I'm looking over my shoulder. I have a very funny story. It's not mine. Well, it is mine, but it's not. I'm not the protagonist. The splits are really, really hard to do for a normal human being. So my sister-in-law got married, I guess, probably 5 years ago, maybe a bit more even. And so what they did was it was over the holidays and they booked some like a resorty place in like Muskoka sort of. And everyone was there for 2 nights. So Friday night was like the rehearsal dinner. And then there was the big party and all the dancing. And then Saturday was the wedding. So my kids were there. My oldest daughter at that time was probably only like 6 or 7, but she's 6 or 7 and she did dance and gymnastics and all that sort of stuff. And so she got to stay up late and was dancing. And so she's doing little kid dancing stuff, but also doing the splits and doing gymnastics stuff. So she's doing the splits on the dance floor at this wedding at this place. And then my wife's aunt, who's actually not much older than I am, she had maybe had a couple of too many adult beverages over the course of the evening. And she sees my daughter doing the splits and she's like, I can do that. And she tries to do the splits and then she kind of like yelped. And then she had to be helped back to the room. And she was the whole next day, she could barely walk. She couldn't wear the shoes that she had brought because she was in too much pain. She was like welts all over her hip, like black and blue, destroyed. Ooh. So find out years later that she didn't just like, oh, that hurt. Don't bend like that anymore. She detached the muscle from her bone, like pulled it right off.
Like her hamstring?
Yeah, like detached it from her leg bone. She had to quit doing Orange Theory. She had to like completely change her whole like fitness and just everything there about being active. She went, the doctor was like, oh my God, like what is wrong? We should have done surgery on this years ago, but now it's too late. And now your leg just kind of sucks. So,
well, it's funny because when I was talking to, I believe it was Kyle Schufelt, and I was asking him about the splits, and of course, like he has retired from gymnastics. He's still an athletic dude. He still coaches gymnastics, so he still has some flexibility. But he was saying, like, he's lost it, right? Like mm-hmm. He can't fully go down on the splits anymore. But I was asking him, like, well, what can happen if the splits go wrong? And he's like, your hamstring could be pulled off completely from the bone. Mm-hmm. That part didn't get into the story because I didn't want to get too graphic. But obviously, like, one of the things that was sort of interesting about it is that the contrast between the different types of splits and the different, like, so with gymnastics splits, maybe your daughter knows this, but you're generally not doing it with a huge amount of force. Usually it's you're kind of gracefully folding into the split. So like, and then mm-hmm. gymnastics routine, you're maybe doing some sort of flip or some sort of element and you land on the ground and then you kind of turn your leg around and you're into a split. Ballet is the same way. Like if you're on the floor, it's usually more graceful. Yoga also, like NHL goaltenders are a little bit more like reactionary. But I think that was one of the parts of the story that was sort of fun to report, is to get like a gymnast reaction, because Kyle Schufelt is like, yeah, I'm a little bit afraid for his hamstring, the way he's like going into them. Like he's going into them very hard. But at the same time, he was kind of like, obviously he's really strong. You could tell, like I think one of the other, I think it was like the ballet dancer was just like, you can just look at him and know that he's really strong. So even though he's kind of going into them fairly forcefully, it looks like he's able to get out of them. It looks like he's being able to handle that sort of ballistic load that is going on. And so it was a really fun story to write, challenging because it's kind of out of, out of
rhythm, right? It's not about pitch counts and RBIs and yeah, it's fun. And
it's hard to put together too, because we're like, well, how do you make a narrative of this? Like, how do you kind of make it make sense? How do you tell, how do you include what people want to read about? Make it fun. Like I said, I didn't want to make it too about like, you know, the anatomy of what's going on in the splits and all the biomechanics of it. But It's a dangerous move.
It's a dangerous move. It's a good reminder of how just supremely athletic, it seems redundant to say, how supremely athletic a professional athlete is. And I've told this story before, and I actually ended up telling it to my kid the other day. We were talking about sitting, and and not hunching over because they're, my kids are working. I'm at home with them and they're doing school from home, and it's easy to get bad habits and kind of hunching, bending your back. And I was talking about hinging at the hips, and I'll never forget when I used to work at the Score. So I used to work at King and Peter, which is just up the street from the Rogers Center. And one day I was walking down the street. Again, I've told the story before, so if you've heard it, you can fast forward. But I saw a guy at the end of the street, and it was him, and there was a woman his age, and there was a young child that was kind of moving around. And as I got closer to this guy, I was like, man, that guy's got some fancy looking pants on. And you know, you could tell his pants were expensive, and they were like high end sweatpants. And as I got closer, I realized that they were like Lululemon sweatpants. And this was like maybe 8-9 years ago when, you know, anyway, his pants were noteworthy, but he was kind of standing with his legs a little bit wider than shoulder width apart, and he was doing his thing, and this little kid was running around. And at one point, he bent down to like scoop the kid up in his arms and stand up. But he didn't bend down. He bent at the hips like he was a hinge. Like his entire lower body didn't move, and his upper body went down in like a move. I was like, it was one of those things where I'm walking down the street and I was like, how did he do that? Like, there's no way I could do that in a million years. Just the way that he did it, he came down, he popped right back up. And then as I got a bit closer and I was about to go into the building, I realized it was Jason Fraser, who was standing on the street corner. And again, this was at that time, he was probably like 35 years old, you know, 400, 500 games in the big leagues. But just that one little thing where it's like, that was so supremely athletic. And all he did was bend down without bending his knees, and he probably didn't make any Robbie Ray grunts when he stood back up like I do getting out of my car, like he just like boom, boom, popped down and right back up. And to hear other athletes acknowledging watching Vlad and be like, I'm scared, but also you could see how just physically strong and just differently strong. We're talking, this is a Pat Tabler cast here. these guys are built and wired and put our bodies in a place that it's hard for us to relate to. And as such, mm-hmm. that there's a 250-pound guy doing the splits at the drop of a hat without a moment's notice. Like, well, better do the splits now. And then you write 800 words about it. And then here we are talking about it. Good times.
800 words, quite a bit more than my editor would have loved 800 words. quite a bit more than 800 words. One of the things that, like, to your point, though, one of the things that I didn't include in the story, was that, well, partly it was like Vlad, the quote where Vlad's like, I didn't even know I could do it. I just kind of looked at the video and I was doing the splits. But one of the things that some of them said to me, which didn't really include, it didn't make the story, but the point was that generally speaking, like, you know, you've hit like sort of the peak athletic form when you can do things with your body that you almost don't expect and you make look easy. And I think like that is kind of the point of what Vlad is doing, is that he's doing the splits. He's making it look easy, but we need to remember, even though he's looking, making it look easy, that is an extremely difficult move that he's doing at first base. It's kind of an incredible feat that he's been able to do. And it looks really awesome. It looks really fun.
It is fun. And it's part of his development at first base. He's repeatedly earned praise and plaudits and looks more than comfortable playing first base this year. My plan to move him back to third might be out the window because he might be ingratiating himself and making himself too valuable over there at first base, splits or otherwise. Let's talk real quick, Caitlin, about what is to come. Blue Jays have some more interleague baseball in their future facing the Philadelphia Phillies, which are a slightly disappointing team. I don't know. No, whatever. They're the Phillies. It's, you can never be too disappointed or too excited about what the Phillies do. The Blue Jays I think they're going to face Aaron Nola this weekend, as well as Vince Velasquez. One of those things is not like the other. But I don't know. Blue Jays are rolling. It should be a good series. Phillies can really hit. They've got They've got Bryce Harper, obviously. They've got JT Realmuto. Anything that you're looking forward to seeing other than the next Alek Manoah start?
You know what's funny? Like some of the Phillies series from last year is like seared into my brain. Like I'm to the point where I'm like, I feel like they just played the Phillies because whatever those series that they played last year against the Phillies were just very memorable. Like, you remember in Buffalo when they came back, I think they were losing like 7-0.
In the 7-inning game, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. There was like two really dramatic losses for Philadelphia, and then the Blue Jays also played them when they were scuffling. I don't know, for some reason. And I remember like didn't we, when we had Matt on
earlier,
like, didn't he say like the Phillies were kind of like the Blue Jays, or maybe you said the Phillies were kind of like the Blue Jays? I mean, that the Phillies are sort of like the alternate scenario if things had gone wrong for the Blue Jays, maybe, like what was happening with them this year, as you say, like they kind of are not quite quite performing. And that division is weird. Like it, mm-hmm. it was supposed to be sort of the more competitive division, or, and I guess it is because they're all so close, because no one's really running away with it. They're all kind of really bunched up there. Like other than Washington, it's kind of falling off. And I guess Miami's kind of falling off too, mm-hmm. but like Atlanta, Philly, and the Mets are kind of like all up there.
At one point in this season, even a week ago, that division was really tightly bunched, and all the teams were below 500.
Yeah.
The Mets have pulled away a little bit again in the early going. They are going to be without Marcus Stroman, Jacob DeGrom for a while. Mm-hmm. But the Phillies are interesting. The Phillies are really old, and that's something that, you know, we spoke about with Matt, and they're kind of the bizarro Blue Jays. I think maybe what we had said was that the 2017, 2018 Blue Jays could be where the Phillies ended up if they weren't careful, because the Phillies have no farm system. They don't have any. There's no Vlad. There's no Bo. There's no Lourdes Gurriel Jr. waiting in the wings to supplant the Gene Seguras of the world and some of the other kind of everyday regulars that are a little long in the tooth there in the Phillies starting lineup and the rotation as well. That's an expensive ball club that's not really quite performing to expectation, but it'll be interesting to watch the Blue Jays navigate them. The Phillies have a terrible bullpen, so all the Blue Jays are going to have to try to get through that starting rotation and get into that disgracefully bad bullpen. The opposite of the Toronto Blue Jays. Caitlin, anything else you got in the lab? Anything about any other athletic feats of strength? Ty-Ty's dunking? Where's the Ty-Ty's dunking story? You got the Vlad split story. Give me the Ty-Ty's throwing down with two hands. Come on.
I'd be game for that. I just haven't had an opportunity to talk to Ty-Ty's. I don't have any stories that are, you know, talking to other athletes and asking them to review a baseball maneuver, but maybe more of those types of stories. People seem to like it. So maybe someone wrote in the comments, like, do another one, ask a quarterback. And like, I can't remember what else they said, like a pole vaulter or something about throwing and comparing it to like an outfield throw, which I don't know if those are really comparable, but
tennis. Tennis is your other beat, your personal, like personal beat. So let's do some get Shapovalov.
Shapovalov?
Shapovalov. Get him in the batting cage. See what he can do. See if he can hit a curveball.
There was I think Daniel Nestor came to the Blue Jays like a few years ago and he took batting practice. I remember I was there for that.
Eric Lindros, there's a famous baseball card or baseball photo of Eric Lindros taking BP. Sidney Crosby hit one into the river in Pittsburgh once.
Yeah,
we're getting down the rabbit hole.
I think Austin Matthews also has ties to baseball. Like you think he played baseball growing up and ultimately chose hockey. But yeah, no, I'll have to think of one of my colleagues here covers the Brewers. He was like, you should do a part two of the split story, which is just you trying to learn the splits. So I take everything that I learned from article one and I, you know, detail my own journey, my own, you know, 6 month journey learning how to do the splits. I don't think I'm going to be able to do that.
You're going
to
start your 40 and dunking vlog. That's the move. That's a middle-aged man 101. I'm going to dunk. I'm going to learn how to dunk again when I'm 40, or I'm going to dunk for the first time when I'm 40. It's not happening.
I'll learn to do splits in my 30s.
Learn to do splits in your 30s. Then you can dunk in your 40s.
There you go.
It's all up from here. Caitlin McGrath, thank you so much. This was great. We're glad to have you back. We're glad that the universe is back aligned. You and I here at the helm, the good ship Spin Rate. Her name is Caitlin. My name is Drew Fairservice. We will talk to you next time on Spin Rate.